There was once a great American named George Henderson. He met a woodland ape or Sasquatch, and despite its dangerous message of environmentalism, became his friend. But when the time came to do the hard thing and send it back into the forest where it belonged, and birds could perch on its shoulder because it was gentle, George Henderson summoned the strength, and by God, he did it. Did it hurt? You bet it hurt. Like a bastard. But he did it because it was the right thing to do. For the woodland ape. You think about that.
What?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Is that Harry and the Hendersons?
You've seen it.
This is my life, Jack.
What makes your book, I thought, so revolutionary, again, to me, was just that you're not saying it has to be one or the other of the human or the primate. You're saying that we're talking about two different things, and beyond that, three or four or five, who knows, how many different bipedal creatures plus a human, you know, a feral human.
What is essential is, as I say, to excise out of it, the Loisy, to excise out of it the evidence for apes in America is not evidence for Yeti. It's not evidence for old world missing links or anything like that. It's our own. These are native. They're our own. They belong to us. The Skookum, the Dasonaqua, they're our own primates. To get at the actual core of what is Sasquatch, you have to get rid of all this other stuff. You have to comb it out and get it out of the way, because Sasquatch was so human to the Indians that they believed they were two tribes of humans. And my contention is, of course, one was and might still be if they're around somewhere. The other is the big controversy that it is a primate so close to humanity in proportion that it can be confused for people by many. I mean, these were always called animal humans in the old journals. Whites or Indians alike, it didn't matter. They were called animal humans. They were so human-like.
Right, and all the sightings presumably are fleeting of those creatures.
Because they move so swiftly, they move so quickly.
Right.
And, I mean, that one 1884 sighting in Oregon, they thought this was a hunter that has been missing for 4 years, John McIntyre. It was so human. They saw this hairy man eating a killed deer raw. There's that old report in the London Times, which I've always been suspicious about, but it appears to be very legitimate, of a hairy wild man about 7 feet tall that they caught in Manitoba and took to France. And it was withdrawn. It behaved in the same way that Colonel Carpathian described that man that they found in Dagestan and faraway Caucasus.
Yeah.
Again, so there are similarities we're dealing when it comes to the people.
Mm-hmm.
We are seen to be dealing with the same type of people spread out.
Right.
And that they apparently, you know, existed, and we refused to believe the Indians. We simply would not listen to them when they said, listen, some of these guys can talk, and they resist civilization. And the Indian artwork and all these various journals from the 18th century on and Russian studies tell us there are people. And they're not missing links, they're people.
Right.
And we overlook that.
Strange.
For the giant.
To imagine a race of, you know.
Well, variations are now being far more understood. We don't have to go into all the anthropology and all the genetics, but no one in the West, any anthropologist in Anglo-American science, would be incensed if someone said Neanderthals were not people. They're humans. There are a few in Europe that hold out saying, well, they're very different. They're lateral evolution. There are some Russians who might say they're not really us, but that would be anathema in Anglo-American science. Listen, these are human beings. I don't think a lot of people know that what was called Homo erectus, the first walking man.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's bit the dust now, too. They said, whoops, you know, the University of Connecticut, the man there, Dr. Lachman, was examining the skulls between these and living people of the Inuit. And they're so close. He said, basically, it seems, you know, that Homo erectus, they're just variation of us. They're just people.
Right.
We have the skulls, we have the bones of people who are dead, who are buried in sediment and preserved as fossils, and these are not missing links. These aren't ape men. These are people who are still living.
Well, you say that, you know, no, we haven't really gotten to the bottom, let's say, of the North American one, you know, because no one's really looking for the right thing. But, I mean, what exactly, how would that really change, I guess you could say, you know, the pursuit of the North American Sasquatch?
Well, I think if we I think we had a better chance of finding it if we realized we were looking for people. I think, you know, it would be an enormous raspberry if people finally understood, if they read my book and understood how the false image developed. You can then see clearly something was behind it.
Right.
I mean, the Bigfooters screwed up, but they weren't making this up.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes, and I do believe there's another tribe that they're still around. And I do believe the other primate, if we can say these are the two true Sasquatch.
Mm-hmm.
That's not Skookum. That's not the Sonoquah. They're gone. We got them out of the way. That the other one would be an old world primate that did migrate over according to the most popular theories. Because as I go into in the book, into Myra Shackley's studies, from her book Wild Men and her research over there and some of the Russian research, they seem to have the same footprint for the Dawn Man, he's called, or the Terek of Siberia, has seems to be the same foot as the Ruby Creek print, which is a humanoid type of foot. And it's described the same way, 6 to 6.5 feet tall. Myra Shackley clarifies for us all that's the same with the people there. They're very short, so they think that's giant. It all ties together, and they're usually seen in October and September and fall months, which is the same for Sasquatch. And so I would have to say that the two Sasquatch tribes, one are people, and the other is this old world type of primate.
Right. But it's not the Laozi or the Almas. We're talking about, you know, almost a whole different subset
of... This is the mystery.
Yeah.
This is the one that we can't get a handle on, except it has an unusually small head, and it has very long legs. It can step over that 48-inch CPR fence. And that is the one, you know, it may sound unusual to say why I ended my book the way I did, but I said, we have to get rid of this fake image. We have to get the enigma back, because the enigma is very true. The object of the search is false, but the enigma is very true. There was this enigma in the North Pacific Northwest for a couple of centuries about these hairy wild men. And we just, you know, you really can't figure out what they're talking about, but they're talking about something genuine. And we completely destroyed that with our belief that this is an 8-9 foot tall Gigantopithecus. That's not it. The enigma is we're not sure what one of these entities really is. Maybe they're both human. Maybe only one is. Maybe neither.
Yeah.
But it seems that something very enigmatic is still behind what is the genuine Sasquatch, that there are people and something very human-like involved.
Amazing, folks. I'm telling you, get this book and read it, because it'll just change your whole perspective on things. Now, you said before we started the interview that you've gotten some flack here, I can imagine.
I have for years from that element that wants to believe in
the
legend.
Yeah.
The legend is fun. I mean, I grew up with it. I believe deeply in the Patterson film. I enjoyed it as a kid. You know, I don't know how old you are. I'm probably older.
I'm only 31, so.
Okay, yes, I'm quite a bit older. So I remember the Sunshine Classic stuff in the 70s. I remember my older cousins with the long hair and the hippie pants and all that, and when Bigfoot was a big deal. And this was, you know, you waited for these documentaries. That was the phenomenon of the decade. They came on an era when there was only three networks, and, you know, these terrible documentaries could get 50 million people watching them back in those days. And that's what we grew up with, this legend of the cone-headed ape man, as you see in Mysterious Monsters, which David L. Wolper, of all people, produced that. He was one of the most credible documentarists there was. Peter Graves narrated that. Wolper produced the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory with Gene Wilder.
Oh, wow.
He was a very credible filmmaker, and so this is what we grew up with, and it is a very fun legend. It is exclusively American. It is campfire Americana, but a lot of it is false. The object is false, but the pursuit is very real. There is something that there is to find out there, and it can be between 6 and 7 feet tall. 7 feet is huge. If you see... That's your door frame in an average home.
Yeah.
If you saw something 7 foot tall standing in your door frame, as thick as the door frame, that's a giant by anybody's standard of ogre.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, the enigma is out there. There is the spirit of what was being broadcast in the 1970s is very true. It's just that the object is false. It is not this cone-headed ape man that that Grover Krantz made very famous and the Bigfooters made very famous. But, you know, when I tell them, when I tell people who deeply believe in that image, they don't wish to believe. They don't want to believe the Loisy is real. I'm going to take flack over that because Yvonne Saunderson, who is a very well-known cryptozoologist and into the, all the phenomena stuff,
mm-hmm.
he condemned it venomously as a hoax and all this kind of stuff. And I have my issues with him. I'm coming out with my another article in my Bigfoot blat online in which I talk about, you know, confessions of a former Saunderson junkie. I go through how much of his stuff I read and how much I discovered he was wrong. But there's a lot of people not going to like that their image, that the popular image is not true. And it's not their burying buddy. These can be very violent. They're smart enough to get in through the roof and come after you, and they're known as a cannibal tribe. And that's what is the terror, something 6 feet tall that is not human, that is smart enough to come after you and doesn't mind what it does to you.
Right, exactly. You point out how the presence of hands alone is the terrifying aspect of it.
Well, it is. As I say, you know, I've had raccoons get into my roof. I've had them rip through my shake. And, you know, that's not terrorizing, but imagine coming home and seeing a 6 foot tall unknown primate sitting on your roof just picking those shakes out and throwing them on the ground ready to come in. And if you're inside, they're coming to get you. And everybody laughed at the Ape Canyon incident, which the miners, Fred Beck being one of them, the very famous Ape Canyon incident in 1924, said that's what they experienced. These had been stalking them for a while, the skookum, as they called them. And then that night they attacked him. One shoved its hand through the chinking in the log cabin, grabbed an axe. I don't know if that much is true or exaggerated, but they were certainly jumping all over the roof and trying to the doors, and they tried to get in there, and they were hurling rocks down on the cabin. And that's the you know, and they had four toes. That's the skookum have four toes. I never clarified that, but we do have a skookum print, and they were said to have four toes, and finally those were found by Canadian law enforcement out in the boondocks. And so we know that's not a Sasquatch. We know that's not human.
Right.
But it's very close to the Ruby Creek print. So that's how we can separate the skookum as something very different.
And it sounds like, you know, extrapolating forward here or, you know, pushing forward to what may come in the future, you wonder almost if, let's say they capture one of these bipedal primates or however, anthropoids as you call them.
They wouldn't even know to associate it with Bigfoot.
Oh, really?
No, because it's not the legend.
Interesting. Okay. See, because that was, in a way, that was kind of what I was going for, but then I was concerned that they would take it and then just sort of push it onto everything and be like, okay, we got the Bigfoot.
Oh, yes.
This is.
They would do that as well, yes. If they would do both, one of all, if they captured this thing that was just a 5 foot tall, looked like a spider monkey in Florida, let's say that's the skunk ape.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that's what they capture, and they say, look, we've got a new species, and someone will find it and say, oh, no, that was shot. Wow, this thing is real.
Right.
You know, Lloyd Deloy was not a hoaxer. He really shot this thing in 1920 in South America. Oh, it would be a big, fun deal, but no one would associate it with a lot of the Indian artwork and evidence we use for Bigfoot.
Right.
We use to prove Bigfoot. But then if it got out, they'd say, oh, this is Bigfoot. The press loves irony. Oh, the reality behind the 8 foot tall missing link is really this 5 foot tall crap flinging monkey.
Right. Joke's on us.
Yeah. And that was just, that's what they love. And so, yeah, it can work both ways, where they wouldn't even recognize this is the Tithonacois, and then where they would say, this is everything.
Yeah.
Forget it. There are no people. There's no skookum. There's nothing else.
And that's you know, where we found ourselves here as a result of this breakdown of research into, I guess, the American Bigfoot, you could say.
I think we'd have to call the skookum the true Bigfoot, because that does, it's my contention, that is a very large,
okay,
6 to 7 foot tall American primate akin to the howler monkey from descriptions of it. And so if we have to say Bigfoot is quintessentially American, that would appear to be the Native American primate that best fits. It's not the 5 foot tall crap flinging monkey that can never make a big, huge foot, but the skookum apparently does. and it's not the Sasquatch, and as I said, it's certainly not a human, and it does not appear to be what could possibly have left the Ruby Creek print. So we should probably call the Skookum truly our Bigfoot.
And by extension, again, on what we were just talking about how they can do both, it seems like this problem will continue until there's the sort of the paradigm shift where they, you know, maybe they capture a Skookum and they capture an Almas, and eventually they're like, wait a minute now, let's stop. Because
you've got more than one.
You know, Gian Gasar was right.
Well, my book's out there as at least some evidence, no matter what they say about me. My book is very illustrated, and it shows with all these reports, these are all old journals that I go into. This is not just repeating hearsay and modern reports and all these subjective sightings. I'm collating and analyzing data. And so there's evidence. I think no one will be able to deny at least that Amaranthropus loisi is real, and that it is a large part of the Indian artwork in the Pacific Northwest, which, as I said, will fry some people. But I think that's going to be very clearly established from just an examination of the Indian artwork. What they do with the rest of it, what they do with the idea of people from other Indian artwork, or that very elusive, true long-footed Sasquatch from Ruby Creek, I don't know. But my book at least stands as evidence someone said this long before one of these is captured and then used for either too little or too much by the press.
Yeah, but we need to keep looking for these different things. If you really sort of synthesize it all, it's like you're saying that, you know, I'm going to butcher the nomenclature here of this, but you're saying there's like a whole different species or something along the lines of sort of like, I always get apes and monkeys confused, but I'm saying like a bipedal primate, right? We're saying a whole bunch of different types.
I'm saying there's a different type of primate that has species within it, which is not necessarily how a zoologist would put it either, but it's best for, you know, getting across one's meaning that the Yeti, the Dawn Man, or Sasquatch, if they're one and the same, the Dawn Man and Sasquatch, I say, are one and the same. But if the Almas, the Yeti, Sasquatch, Skookum, Loisi, we know is real, I'm very convinced of that because of the photo and the artwork.
This is the Orang Pendek as well, right?
Right, whatever that could be, from the descriptions of the small man of Sumatra. These are not apes in the strict sense. They're not monkeys. They're not people, certainly. But they seem to be different species of a general type of primate, and that type is something that is far more closely related to monkeys. They are anthropoids, so maybe a strict zoologist would say, listen, that makes them apes. But they are not the short-legged waddlers of Africa, or the orangutan, that are not very impressive primates. These are long-legged guys that can move. They can move really quick, and that makes them look far more like human beings.
Yeah.
But they're not. They're not a missing link either. They are reconcilable with certain species of monkeys. So we have something that's a very separate type, very separate class of primate. It's not man. It's not the great apes. It's not the monkeys.
It's a whole different thing.
Yeah. With many species within it.
This is some radical stuff, Gian. I'm telling you. I mean,
it would be.
What's that?
Yes, it would. That's what would get me yelled at the most, saying that there's people might accept that Neanderthals are still around. They can accept the Loisi, but that what the Loisi suggests is that there is an entire separate class of primates that is much more closely related to the monkeys, yet is more man-like in appearance than the apes. Closer to us because they're bipedal. When I say closer, I don't mean evolutionary wise. I mean simple by appearance. They're bipedal.
Right.
They can haul it on their hind legs easier. Well, it's a hard subject to talk about. I hope people buy the book because
I think they will.
Better in the book.
Yeah, and I'm
going to say this guy thinks there's something behind every bush, and that's not the case.
No, not at all. Not at all. No, I'm trying to drive the point home to people to try and get the main idea to them that what the hell you're trying to explain to them. It's like, I can already hear them being frightened of what you're telling them because it threatens the very fabric of what they believe. But at the same time, it makes so much more sense. It's unbelievable. It like I said, I'm completely tongue-tied in a way trying to discuss this book because it's so different from anything I would have even considered or thought about. So kudos to you, dude, for having the balls to go out and write this and for doing the research because it's amazingly well documented, a lot of the stuff in there.
Thank you very much. We have to remember one thing, too, you know, that Japanese soldiers, there's a couple of incidents where they didn't surrender on Okinawa.
Yeah.
And on Guam until 28, 30 years after it was big news in the early 70s when, or the Philippines, when they surrendered. It's not difficult, given all of Siberia and Pacific Northwest, for a bipedal primate, for an animal, to remain very elusive still. So we can have a few species that remain undiscovered, and it's really not so phenomenal a statement as it might sound. We're talking about a huge amount of the Earth.
Yeah.
In which these are very adapted to living in. So it's not like I'm talking about, you know, 5-6 different species in your small town.
Exactly, yeah. We're talking like all over the world here. Now, I mean, did you look at the Yowie at all, the Australian version of, you know, Sasquatch,
no,
Bigfoot,
no,
et cetera?
No, I really didn't get into that. I'd had enough. I had enough. Because Yeti and Sasquatch are the basis out of all, from what all this leads
right.
in the popular form. I had to start with those two and start dissecting from there.
There's always room for a sequel, so. Now, let's say money was no object, okay? And we talked about how, you know, they're going about looking for this thing the wrong way, and they should be looking for people and or, you know, a bipedal primate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's say money was no object, and, you know, how would you even do that? How is that any different than going to look for the classic Bigfoot, I guess you could say, or the misconceived?
It would be very different.
Okay, how?
Very different. One, the classic Bigfoot's really never been looked for since P&E.
Okay.
And they were looking for Ray Wallace, and they didn't know it. And so for the bipedal primate, my first goal is to try and nab one of the Americans. One of the Native Americans, some Adloidzi or a Skookum, if we believe the Skookum is based on the howler, related to the howler. And so I have my own interdict theory, which does involve the mountain range Sierras going down through Arizona into Mexico, believing they are migrating up north from South America.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would interdict as certain areas first establishing footprints that they are moving in a certain pattern, and then find a certain area, which I won't state,
yeah,
along the Bigfoot hunters are the most paranoid about talking about where they're working.
So you actually have a place in mind, you mean?
Yes. Where it would be, that's my interdict theory, where try and get one, dart it as it's coming through a certain area of the Sierras, coming northward from South America.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be for the primate.
Right.
That would, of course, be being able to maintain a base camp and trackers who can go out telling me, you know, how it's advancing through footprints and make sure it's not past us. And for the humans, I would have to say, you know, only up in Canada, only up in that legendary area of the Nahanni Valley where Indians spoke of headhunters who lived up there still, or deep into, I don't think anybody's ever been to Morris Mountain, which is, by Indian legend, the actual Sasquatch Indians, is the center of all Sasquatch territory. That's what J.W. Burns made clear in his various writings, that the Sasquatch meet at Morris Mountain once a year and have their big ritual.
Oh, boy.
And no one's ever made it there. The first two guys to ever try were brothers, the Blakeney brothers of Sacramento, here in California. This was in 1937, I believe. There was so much hoopla over the Harrison Hills incident of 1934 that got national news in Canada and the United States, when the Indians insisted that the Sasquatch men were attacking Harrison Hills and some of the reservations. This was quite a big deal in British Columbia, because whites and Indians alike were arming themselves. There was this eerie howling at night. Fences were being broken down. Livestock released to where outsheds broken into. And so a whole bunch of vigilantes finally went on the search for the Sasquatch men, which, of course, the Indians were saying were giants and which white men were believing were 8-9 foot tall, and never found any. Never brought them to book. And that's really then in 1934 what made whites disbelieve the Indians, and the Indians got very sensitive. But it got made so much news. It was in the Sacramento, it was in the Fresno Bee, it was in Michigan newspapers, it was in Montreal Standard, all these papers talking about these giant Indians. The Blakeney brothers, med students, went up there in 1937, talked to J.W. Burns. He told them the whole scoop, and they tried to get toward Morris Mountain.
Yeah.
And I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks later, they finally came back just wiped out. They couldn't make it. It is just too treacherous to try and get anywhere close to it. And to this day, I don't think anybody's ever been to the heart of the Sasquatch of the Chehalis.
That's amazing.
And that's where you would have to go find people.
That is amazing to think about. You make the point in the book that we think the world is a smaller world now, but, you know, there's a mountain out there that no one's ever been to. That's...
I believe so. I believe no one's been to Morris Mountain. I really, unless they were in by helicopter. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it is just so treacherous.
Certainly not a publicized trip or anything like that.
No.
That's what you're
saying. We would have heard about it.
Right.
People don't know how unexplored British Columbia is in the heartland.
Now, would you go to this mountain? Is it still treacherous to try and get there?
Oh, yes, because of the gorges, and they end in dead ends, and you can't cross to the other land. I mean, it's like a land that time forgot.
Wow.
And that's what they were saying, why the Indians deserted. They were guides back in 1934, deserted all the white men going out to try and bring the Sasquatch men to book for all the damage they did in Harrison Hills. That the Indians kept abandoning them because it was just so treacherous to get there, and the closer they got to Sasquatch country, the more they didn't want to have anything to do with it.
If I wasn't grossly out of shape, I'd suggest that you and I should go.
Well, there's a few people who do want to go. I have my own organization, PNENS, which is Pacific Northwest Expedition in Siberia, because that's obviously what I'm talking about in the book, that area. And so I have people who, you know, one day I hope to get it going. I'm going to do the interdict theory first. That's along the Sierras.
Yeah.
I have the people to do that, try and get the Native American primate. But it would take quite a lot to finally get into Canada, try and get to Morris Mountain. But I hope at least my book stimulates some who want to, who know what they're looking for, who know this is the last thing you wish to kill.
Yeah.
Because that's not going to do anything. That just proves that you were looking for something and you found it. But it doesn't tell us all we need to know.
Right. So, yeah. So the age-old Bigfoot kill versus no-kill debate, you're squarely on the side of no-kill.
No, there's no reason to kill. If, you know, it's clear, true footage would be undeniable. The Patterson film has so many problems with it. There's a reason why zoologists started laughing when they were watching it. I mean, it's very well done. It's a great hoax.
Right.
But, I mean, what you're looking at is just some monster. It's not something that is zoologically possible.
I look at the Patterson-Gimlin film in the same way almost as like the Roswell case in ufology, where it's just too old, it's too muddy, there's too much contradiction, there's too many stories surrounding it to be of any real value anymore to the field.
It's an overkill. That's what happens with a lot of the folklorists. They have enough stories and they keep ginning these things out instead of going and really looking for new data, adding thereto, taking it a step further.
And you make the point in the book, too, that after they made the film there, then they just started looking for Bigfoot like all over the place in the area and didn't really do a concentrated search of the Bluff Creek area. Is that?
Yeah. That's amazing. That's the most amazing thing I ever saw. I mean, what did they believe? Here they believed John Green, Rene de Hinden, a couple of other major Bigfooters expressed their belief. This is a genuine article that what Patterson filmed. Well, there you go. You have proof of Bigfoot, but not only proof of Bigfoot, but proof of Bigfoot at Bluff Creek. Why weren't they out there with all these rifles and scopes and cameras? Why did they go all over the whole Pacific Northwest? They merely used Bluff Creek and the Patterson film to promote an entire phenomenon that they were endorsing.
Yeah. It's very strange.
That's beyond logic. You know, there are people who deeply believe that Nessie exists at Loch Ness. Well, you know, they went out there with all these portables, with all these camera equipments. They were manning the lake constantly, roundabout, cameramen there. Well, that's a logical response.
Yeah.
P&E, Tom Slick's P&E, is misguided as it was nevertheless a logical response to the belief that these footprints were real and they really indicated some kind of subhuman or something, some yeti that was there. What's a logical response to set up base camps and be patrolling and searching the area and have brownie box cameras and all sorts of stuff that they did for a few years? But here, after this Patterson film, after this seemingly undeniable proof in 1967, I mean, the Bigfooters do not come back. They just go all over. They're just promoting all these all these things about the new Sasquatch, and they're following up on all these popular eyewitness sightings now of the cone-headed giant.
Yeah, yeah.
No one pays attention to the Indians saying these are people.
Well, the P&E couldn't have, those brownie box cameras couldn't have been much good if Renee DeHinden kept stealing all the film out of them anyway, right?
Yeah, I couldn't believe he admitted to that in his book and didn't realize what he was saying. I couldn't believe that he just took the film out of those and used his own camera and didn't tell Titmus and Green, and here they're putting food on the end of the pull string.
Yeah, the whole era of
the carnival.
Yeah, it was comical. I really enjoyed the appearances of Rene DeHinden throughout the book as well, because he just seemed so caustic, and at the same time almost a little way bitter almost as it progressed towards the end. And he makes the point that he didn't have time for a wife or a family or kids or a dog or a mortgage or any of that crap.
Yeah,
he had to search for Bigfoot.
One of the funniest ones imagined. he was, as I said, it's a catch-22. He's kind of the father of all the error. He's the genuine first Sasquatch hunter, and he wanted that made clear. He's the first one that took this seriously, and he's the first one that made sure they believed it was a Yeti.
Why do you think they made such a fundamental mistake, though? It just boggles the mind that no one... You know, ever...
No, I don't know how he had... Ralph Izzard was the Daily Mail journalist. He was in charge of the famous Daily Mail expedition, along with Charles Stoner, who was the zoologist. DeHinden had Izzard's book. He mentioned Abominable Snowman Adventure. He has Izzard's book. He saw the footprints of the Yeti, the Shipton print.
Right.
He's heard the descriptions of the Yeti as the size of a 14-year-old boy, which is closer to 5 feet tall, with a tall cone head, with this crest over the top. That's no Bigfoot. That's no Sasquatch man. He had that. Why he chose to? I mean, he got to know Green. He must have seen early on Green's tracing of the Ruby Creek print. Why could he possibly look at both of those and say it's the same thing?
So clearly, you have no ties to the paranormal connection to Bigfoot that's sort of in vogue now, or the interdimensional aspect of it.
No. I'm looking for something very tangible. It's one of the most disturbing things to me to see a unexplained or mystery topic in the public forum, something that becomes very popular. Well, it eventually is never proven, and so these new chapters keep being added, and so much froth keeps being added to it. I don't wish to hear about all the UFO stuff, about the red-eyed monsters in the night, and bow-legged women walking out there trying to be mothers of a new species. You know, that is not my world. I am looking for something that I believe is very real and can be explained and can be captured, and does have a very clear origin. For two of them, anyway, our own Desonaqua and Skookum in South America, that they are actually Native American apes, if you must.
Now, at the risk of treading into even more tenuous territory, have you looked at the whole bipedal canine issue?
You mean werewolf?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't want to mention that. I didn't know there was still a big issue. So if we are we talking about a bipedal lemur or lemur, if you like?
I suppose more. Yeah, well, bipedal canine. I speak specifically of Linda Godfrey and her research primarily.
I don't follow that. I follow such as I speculated, not in the book because I didn't want to go that route. But if we have something like the Loisy, which, as I said, I think is pretty undeniable on all the circumstantial evidence in the picture, if we have an anthropoid, bipedal anthropoid. That looks that obviously is closely related to a known genus of small quadruped monkey with a long tail, that does open up the door for something like the lemur, which is a primate. It's a monkey body and tail with, I guess you call it a wolf or a dog's head. What if there was an equivalent of the Loisy in that species? What if there was a bipedal lemur? It would look like a werewolf. It would, you know, be tailless, bipedal. It would have hands.
Yeah.
But it would have a bear or a wolf's head, which is what the lemur looks like.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of one right now, yeah.
imagine that 6 foot tall and bipedal.
That would be
without a tail.
Yeah, you think it was some kind of werewolf?
And so I don't really research where the origin of werewolves begin in popular legend. If something like that did exist, a lemur, a bipedal giant lemur, something like that anyway, like the Loisy, and that inspired it, and then you know you get all the folklore with it, as we did with Bigfoot.
Right.
But I don't know if that's the research of the lady you talked about.
No, well, I don't think she's suggesting that, but maybe if she reads your book, she'll sort of shade that into her research, because it brings up the whole idea there that that's probably could be what it is. I mean, if we're dealing
if we establish the Loisy is true, then that does open up the door. If one monkey species, as common as the spider monkey from South America, has an anthropoid version, for lack of a better word, that would never be a scientific word used, version, if it has an anthropoid relative, why could another monkey species, why could another primate species not have an anthropoid closely related to it?
Yeah, exactly. So what's the reaction to cryptozoology or Bigfootery, I guess you could say, to this Loisy thing? They've just completely thrown it out? It's completely, you know, verboten?
I don't even hear them talking about it. Someone put up a website right away. I have the pre-release of my book out. It's not general release, I think, for another week. But it's the printer. I have links up to the printer where people can buy my author's edition hardcover instead of the general release paperback.
Yeah.
Someone had a website up saying that, you know, with the name of my book, Recasting Bigfoot, that proof of Bigfoot or something is the Amerinthropodus Loisy, and it was Bigfoot proven. That's it, in 1870, and that would be the encounter De Groot had in California by Pacheco Pass, where he describes a male and female 5 feet tall that were whistling like the reports in South America.
Yeah.
Which is my opinion, our Loisy is coming north. But there's nothing to that page yet. So I guess some are getting ready, but people really don't talk about Loisy in that connection, because here we're talking about a 5 foot tall something, what is it, in South America, which no one is going to relate to Indian artwork and stone heads in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
And then moreover, relate to an 8 or 9 foot tall cone head from the Himalayas.
Exactly. Exactly. It's yeah. It's
so that's what's going to take a lot of people by surprise. Is that, well, that's why I named it Recasting Bigfoot. I'm not destroying Bigfoot. We're going to have to start calling something else Bigfoot than what we have been.
That brings up the whole nomenclature idea of it. So you think we should just ditch the whole big? Obviously, I'm kind of the opinion that we should ditch the Bigfoot name, because it's kind of silly at this point. But we're stuck with
it. Yeah. I've been on radio shows saying that Bigfoot is a hoax, Sasquatch is real. And that makes it far more easy. But I don't think the Bigfoot name will ever be ditched. We'll have to just, my contention is to say, listen, it's the Skookum. It's this long four-toed print is the true Bigfoot. This is our Native American primate. That's a lot bigger than the Loisy. So this is a giant. It's closer to what we're talking about in the legend. But I don't know if that'll ever happen. But it is easier to say Bigfoot is a hoax and Sasquatch is real.
There you go.
And then tell people what Sasquatch is. Go through the whole thing again of one human, one primate.
And then that primate's just part of a larger set of different primates that are running around the globe.
One species within a greater type.
Exactly, yeah. Well, it just seems like this thing's just going to end up being solved by accident anyway at this point.
I think we're really going to have to stalk them.
Really?
My interdict theory, I think, could pull out if I can get enough information in advance of a couple moving north along the mountains and finally set up basically an area where we can survey and have guys who are appropriately licensed to dart one when they try and cross a certain area of the Sierras. Otherwise, I don't think anybody's just going to, if they do walk across one by accident and just shoot it out of fear, I mean, we've proven one is real, but we've lost so much data.
Yeah, and you make the point, you really need a live one to sort of get a better understanding of what this creature is.
Right. See how it walks, see how it behaves, see how it interacts.
As I said, I'm 31 here, so I sort of grew up in the era of the Unsolved Mysteries and those Time Life books and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it seems like in the time since then, as I grew older and got more into this, that the biggest breakthrough, I guess you could say, in Bigfootery was this whole dermal ridges thing, and sort of like a, for lack of a better term, fingerprint of Bigfoot prints. What's your take on all that in light of what you've studied?
Then there are all these funny enlarged human feet, and that's not what we're looking for. People know how to fake dermal ridges. You just shove your own handprint or footprint in there, and there's a dermal ridge.
Yeah.
In the mud, that's what that hoaxer in Indiana did, J.W. Parker. That apparently there was a bit of skeptical inquirer timed that just right for Grover Krantz's first time he released his book under the title Big Footprints in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And we all waited for that because that was the expert speaking out after 22 years. And then Skeptical Inquirer ran the article by Michael Dennett in which J.W. Parker confessed having hoaxed the Indiana print, which Krantz used as the best evidence for a Sasquatch east of the Rockies. And this had, you know, the wonderful dermal ridges. It had other evidence that Krantz said is beyond hoaxer's kin. And Dennett asked Parker what he did. And he used a walnut for the big toe, so it really looked interesting. And he put in scars and toenails. And so that it, then, you know, used his own handprint to make it look like the ball of a foot pushing off. You know, so it was real, like a real working, moving foot.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's not too ingenious. That's something I would expect a hoaxer to know how to do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just how many types of footprints are we going to accept for the same thing? It's the enlarged, funny human foot, the 17, 18, 20-inch human foot is not what the Indians spoke about. That's not what Dunn traced at Ruby Creek. That certainly is not the Yeti. And so when you see these funny enlarged human feet, they're not Neanderthal footprints, which are very distinctive. I mean, they're not truly human footprints. They're like a Jokestorf, you know,
right.
Flat human footprint. Some sticker you take off the bottom of a tub when I was a kid in the 1970s.
So to the people out there who are listening and they're, you know, their minds have been blown by now with all this information, what the big point of the book, too, tries to get across, I guess you could say, is here's what's good evidence and here's what's bad evidence. And to sort of summarize here, the good evidence, you know, is the photograph of the footprint from the Himalayas, the the Lozi.
As
the Yeti, there you go. The Losi picture and description of the body and all, you know, the entire encounter. And
from 1920 in Venezuela.
Okay. And the Ruby Creek one with the tracing.
1941, yes, by Joe Dunn and S.A. Tifting.
Right. So those are like the three best pieces of evidence to what
and
we're going for.
And then for the Skookum, yes, there was a report in Idaho of a human monster, as I call it, at a club and branched it and scared the heck out of ice skaters at John Gooch's ranch, which is hard to explain what they're talking about, a four-toed print. Well, then the four-toed prints also turn up at Mount St. Helens, the legendary home of the Skookum. And then the Canadian Mounted Police discovered two sets of four-toed prints in Manitoba in 1988, and a conservation officer did in Manitoba in 1973, so that apparently the long foot monkey-like heel with four toes is genuinely the Skookum. So we would say that that does indicate another species.
Yeah.
I would anyway.
Yeah. And for the bad evidence, folks just should throw out the Patterson-Gimlin film, throw out
Bluff Creek,
the whole furor of that, and the cripple foot, that's a no-go as well.
Yeah, I know. That's just a walk up the hill for someone to take a... how to clean that up. From the evidence, that was 1,089 footprints of someone who simply walked up a hill, walked around a tree, stood for a while, and took a whiz... Put it in
layman's terms.
For the kids. Walked down, jumped over the fence three times, walked back and forth over the fence a few times to just to accentuate the fact this is jumping over a fence and not a pointless walk up the hill, walked back down toward the river, and the tracks disappeared in the river. That's the Cripplefoot cast. And all that came from that destroyed Bigfooteries, old Bigfooteries' reputation in what was an enormous national news coverage of the Bosberg fiasco. Those, unfortunately, were the pillars of Grover Krantz's evidence, and that's very disappointing and shocking. And from there, really in his hands, he created the Gigantopithecus based on what DeHinden and John Green were already promoting. He just gave the appearance of scientific endorsement to their concoctions.
It's mind-blowing stuff. I think it's amazing material. People should definitely check it out. Recasting Bigfoot is the title, of course, and Bermuda-Triangle.org is the website, right?
Yes, I have a subsite for all my Bigfoot research. I just didn't want to pay for another website.
There you go.
This one cost me enough a month.
And have you gone to war with the Bigfooters yet over the book, or are we waiting for, like, the general release, then, you know, the rebuttals and the rebuttals to the rebuttals?
I guess we'll be waiting for that. That's when it might get nasty, or they might just ignore me, which is fine with me, as long as people read it. And I don't see how they can. If I did my data right and explained it properly, at the very least, at least they know something truly does exist, and it is not the cone-headed giant.
You did an amazing job explaining it. I mean, as I said, it takes a while to sort of sift through the nomenclature of it and sort of wrap your mind around that we're dealing with a whole bunch of different things, because people are so conditioned to the idea that we're dealing with one creature that lives around the world, and that, mm-hmm. what you're saying, is certainly not the case.
That is not the case. No, it's not Harry and the Hendersons. It's not that. That's the popular image of Bigfoot, and that
right.
does not exist.
And that's not even, yeah, and that's a confabulation of
white man's mistakes, basically.
Essentially, yeah, and the hijinks of the original Bigfoot, you know, era, if you will.
The original Bigfooters, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether innocent or not, certainly they were accusing each other of so many different things. There were some who did not like the others. But some of it is just innocent, well-intentioned mistake. Some of it's very poor research. Some of it probably is quite manipulated.
Well, since you say there's no good sightings since the 1980s here in America and everything else, well, I guess what do you make then of the last 30 years of Bigfoot research?
It's an attempt to glorify the old Bigfooter. It's an attempt to glorify and just add on their own chapters. But in the popular form and in the real accepted case of sightings, no, there are no really good sightings. Even John Green was good enough to say that it's, you know, when he updated his famous On the Track of Sasquatch as Bigfoot Sasquatch evidence in 2004, it basically just leaves off with that 1979 report by Officer Dillon.
Yeah.
And he says most of the stuff today coming into the internet are usually from pranksters, and it's tough trying to pick out the real stuff. And when these guys, we have to remember, do try and pick out the real stuff, they're looking for something that conforms to the legend. It's
right.
All and bipedal and cone-headed.
Right. It's just a huge mess.
Anti-theory. By scientific word would be anti-theory. It's anti-science. It's anti-theory. It is a falsehood that it makes all data false. It collates data and makes it inaccurate.
My God.
So that's what they would call anti-theory. It actually creates falsehood.
Yeah. Just amazing. Just really, you've given me a lot to think about here over the remainder of my career here in the paranormal. It's just completely changed what I think of all this. And I hope folks go out and get it, because it was amazing.
They should be able to find it everywhere. I don't think Borders has it. I hear bad things about Borders going under.
Yeah, I've been hearing that too.
But when I went in to buy one of my own books for someone who's doing a tour and wanted the price to be autographed books from my first one into the Bermuda Triangle, they didn't have them, and they wouldn't order them for me. They said I could just order it online at home.
Jeez.
So, you know, what's the point of going into the bookstore?
Well, why do you think they're going
Barnes
under?
I know Barnes & Noble will have it. Barnes & Noble and Amazon will certainly have it.
Well, that's good, yeah. And people can find out more, of course, at Bermuda-Triangle.org. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we need to cover here. I mean, we've pretty much really beating the drum quite a bit on this. What do you think? Is there anything we missed?
As I said, the object of the legend is false, but the pursuit is very real. There is something to find. There really is a need to go out with your Scotch plaid flannel shirt and your Elmer Fudd hat and swing your rifle over your shoulder and go start traipsing the wilderness, because there really is something very, very fascinating to find.
Right, right. But it's not Harry and the Hendersons.
No, it is not.
All right, so we've sort of led people down the road to go get the book. They definitely should. I mean, I really can't put this over enough. Hopefully they've gotten the point of how amazing and thought-provoking this book is just by how agog I am during this conversation. I didn't expect this when I picked it up. I thought, you know, that you were really going to sort of disprove some of the classic Bigfootery, but not really a wholesale reevaluation of this phenomena. So kudos to you on that, because it was just tremendous stuff. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, hearing the rebuttals from people and hearing your take on those and your responses to that. So, you know, I know you said you prefer if they leave you alone, but I'm afraid they probably won't, because this is such a heretical book.
Well, that's a good. Well, that's going to invite them right now.
Oh, no, no.
I'll be ready. I don't flinch. You know, I don't. I take the public forum very seriously. I didn't do research for all these years just to put out some kind of tripe. I mean, I had some big publishers who were interested in this before things went south, when they wanted to change my title. They actually just wanted to make it sound like a book talking about Bigfoot. And I said that their title's The Truth About Bigfoot and Case Stories. And I said, that's not what this book is about. I'm recasting an entire phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I would not yield my title, and they just, you know, tell you to beat it.
Well, you know, kudos to you, dude, because this is a bold book. This is really something shocking. That's the best way I can put it. It's stunning. So, I mean, go out and get it, folks. And while we got you for a little bit longer, at least just, you know, sort of preview the, you got two books out right now, of course. The other one's They Flew Into Oblivion. So tell people about that. We addressed in depth your Bermuda Triangle research last time you were on, but this is like a whole nother kettle of fish.
Yes, this is something I think a little more controversial than the first book was a general overview of the triangle. This is the one case that made the triangle famous that eventually got everybody interested, and this is the disappearance of the five Avengers in 1945 that astounded everybody, and then the rescue plane, the PB Martin Mariner, and went looking for them. So in one night, 14 men vanished on those Avengers and 13 on the PBM. So the Navy lost 6 planes without trace and 27 men. And that began world interest in the very concept of disappearances out there, and that eventually led to the area being named the Bermuda Triangle in 1964. Well, this book is really quite an exposé of the whole Flight 19 incident. And it is the one, this as a manuscript, did inspire the resolution in Congress in 2005 already, when Larry Landsman, who was the special projects director at Sci-Fi Channel, took it to lobbyists, the whole subject matter. And so E. Clay Shaw from Florida sponsored it, and it passed 422. And the book details what really did go on that day, what the Navy controversy and complicity, and my evidence that the flight actually did not even disappear in the Bermuda Triangle, but it did, in fact, disappear in the Okefenokee Swamp in southern Georgia. And there's simply too much evidence that leads to Navy complicity and incompetence, into some incidents that happened in the flight, to a change in command. It goes into an awful lot. There's enough to talk about for another hour, which we can't.
Yeah.
I don't recommend any author have two books come out a month and a half apart. And then a third one is coming out, which is my fiction, my thriller debut, Soma, which I base on a lot of the nonfiction information that does exist about Alexander the Great's lost body and tomb in Alexandria. So I kind of weave that into my first thriller, which is entitled Soma, and that is going to be out in December. And so that's basically three books that I was editing at the same time and going crazy over.
Well, now that you've got those together now, what is, you know, the obvious question that we always end the show on here? What's next for you? Sounds like you're sort of going to be emerging a little bit more in the world of Bigfootery, at least, you know, maybe putting your other foot, you know, solidly into that realm as well as in the Bermuda Triangle.
People will probably be hearing more about expeditions. I've really kept that offline and who I deal with in my PNENS. And so I think they'll be hearing more, maybe seeing even, I'm trying to get film footage up of Expedition online, you know, YouTube, you can have your own channel there, and a diary page where I'm keeping track of stuff. And maybe I'll just do little paperback updates, like in the old days when John Green published those, you know, original paperbacks, 8x11 stuff. When it is warranted, But my actual next project is getting out the book on the disappearance of the USS Cyclops, which is the biggest mystery in the U.S. Navy. And that will be Hellship, and that's going to be out in spring of next year.
Oh, wow.
And it discusses whether the disappearance of the Cyclops really was our mutiny on the Bounty. Whether this ship did suffer mutiny or treason and was destroyed and all of our men wiped out and the few mutineers escaped.
Interesting. Okay. So people should be on the lookout for that. Hellship, you say?
Hellship, yes.
I like that title. All right. And, of course, folks, check out Bermuda-Triangle.org for more information from Gian. Well, I think that this is definitely going to be one episode of the program that people are going to be talking about, not just in the immediate future, but for quite some time. Just fabric-changing material here in this book. It is stunning stuff. It gave me a whole new perspective on the Bigfoot phenomenon that I'd never even considered before. And as I said, you know, I've already gone through my own evolution in thought on this subject. So it really just changed my whole perspective on this, and I can't put it over enough. And folks should definitely go out and get this, because if you are interested in Bigfoot, you don't know the half of it, because there's so much more going on here. And you, Gian Cassar puts it all together here in the book. Recasting Bigfoot, uncovering the truth about Sasquatch amidst the hype of Bigfoot. This has been a fascinating conversation, Gian. Thank you for coming on the show. I know the book is just coming out now. I haven't seen you anywhere else just yet. I assume you're going to be on doing the rounds all over the place. And
we'll see what kind of publicity I get, or if I get chased out of town.
Hey, listen, if you're chased out of town, there'll always be a place for you here on VOA Audio, so don't even worry about that. We are more than happy to give you a voice, because what you're saying is bold stuff, and it's not bold stuff in the sense that it's so crazy that, you know, this isn't laughably bold. This is thought-provokingly solid, bold stuff. This is amazing. So thank you once again for coming on the show, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Huge thanks, of course, to Gian Cassar for coming on the show. You can find out more from him at the website www.bermuda-triangle.org. Don't be put off by the URL. There is a ton of information there on recasting Bigfoot, including information on how you can get your hands on a copy of this thought-provoking book. Moving right along now, it's time for the first installment of BOA Audio Listener Feedback here on Season 6. And since it is the first time around this season, we're going to do 4 emails, so if you don't like listening to me talk, tough cookies. First email comes from Sean, no hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. I've been catching up on some BOA, yes, I love the show, and heard you responding to Mags, giving you a sound spanking for swearing. I guess she had a fair point, but let me say this, Tim, don't stop swearing. I know you won't anyway. Swearing is an art and a science. I enjoy swearing, and I enjoy hearing it. Also, I smoke, too, and I always smile to myself when I hear your lighter go snick. Never forget, smoking is cool. All right, buddy, take it easy. Sean. First of all, thank you, Sean, for your endorsement of both my swearing and my smoking. I think I've cut down on the swearing for the most part here on this show. You can go to listen to the podcast, though. The swearing is in abundance on that program. I will disagree with you, though. Smoking is not cool. It costs way too much money, and it costs way too many lives, and if I could quit, I would do it in a heartbeat, but I'm just shackled to these gruesome, gruesome cigarettes. It is really not a very pleasant habit, and one I've tried to rid myself of over the years, as longtime listeners of the program know. Nonetheless, Sean, I appreciate your support, and I'm glad you like the snick of the lighter. I do include those in the program to keep that raw feel of the show. You know what's going on with me while I'm doing the interview. I'm smoking some butts and talking to the guests. That's the BOA way, for better or for worse. Thanks again for writing in, Sean. Much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed digging in to the BOA audio archive. Next email comes from Candace, no hometown listed. Here's what she has to say. I discovered your podcast today and spent the majority of my day cleaning house, putting up Christmas lights, etc., with you in my ear. I've listened / subscribed to many podcasts, only to be disappointed by horrible hosts that remind me of Beavis and Butthead. so I'm so excited to find another quality podcast with awesome guests. Great show, can't wait to go through more of the back catalog, yay. Signed, Candace. Thank you for writing in, Candace. Much appreciated for your feedback. I don't really have anything too in-depth to say in response to this one, except just that these are the kind of emails that give you just a warm feeling inside, kind of like the emails we get from the international listeners. It's just humbling to me to think that Candace is out there somewhere putting up her Christmas lights and listening to BOA Audio. I'm in the Candace home somehow, and thank you, Candace, for welcoming me into your home. I really appreciate it, and it really just makes me almost tongue-tied to express the weird but humbling and also appreciative feeling I get when I hear from folks like Candace who write in and say that I'm keeping them company while they put up Christmas lights or riding to work with them every morning or, you know, keeping them up at night while they try to get to sleep. So thanks for writing in, Candace. Really appreciate your email. Email number 3 is a response to last week's season premiere. It comes from Brian, no hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. Season 6 sounds like it's off to a great start. I always enjoy hearing Jim Marr's take on things. I'm writing to let you know that the Federal Reserve is audited every year, and it can be accessed through public record. Please research about CAFRs, Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports. Everything you want to know about where the money goes is in that document. All politicians know this. The whole audit the Fed thing is a smokescreen. Here's a link to prove my point. And the URL for that is www.cafrnumber1.com/fraudit.html. Let me give you that again. cafr.com/fraudit.html. Blessings to you and yours this holiday season, Brian. First of all, right back at you, Brian, on the holiday season blessings. Thank you, sir. Much appreciated, and hope you have a great holiday season as well. Truth be told, I haven't had a chance to check out this link that Brian sent me, but I wanted to share it with all you folks here at the end of the program. Regardless of who we have on the show, week in and week out, we always want to give you the best information available. So if somebody writes us in after the fact with new information or a correction or a challenge, we try to share it with you listeners at the end of the show. So check out that link I gave you that Brian sent and find out for yourself what he's talking about and make up your own mind about this Federal Reserve audit issue. Thank you, Brian, for writing in. Thank you for sharing the information with the BOA Audio listeners. That's what this program is all about. Great guests with great information and awesome, intelligent listeners like you, Brian, with open minds. And the final email here this week on BOA Audio listener feedback comes from Pauline, no hometown listed. Here's what she has to say. I'm not sure how I happened upon your site, but I am really glad that I did. I've been listening to all of the archived MP3s. They're really great. There's one that I want to listen to, but when I click on it, a weird advert comes up. It's the Paula Harris interview from 11/4/2006. Is it me, or is there some kind of funkiness happening? Don't worry, I'm not some podcast vampire sucking free entertainment from your site. I'm waiting until Friday, payday, to donate money to the site. I'll donate weekly, otherwise I'd feel too guilty to listen. So far, my favorite guests have been George Knapp, Adam Davies, and Angela Joyner from Stephenville, Texas. I liked that all these people seemed level-headed and rational, yet have an open mind about extra-earthly subjects. I live in Boston and work downtown in one of the most boring financial firms on the planet, so your podcasts are a godsend. Thank you again for the entertaining and intelligently done audio casts. If you need any help with anything at BOA HQ, send me an email. I'd love to get involved. Thanks again, Pauline. What a great email from Pauline. Let me touch on a few talking points contained in this one. First of all, Pauline has hit a hot topic among BOA Audio listeners, and that is the Paula Harris interview from 11/4/2006 when we made the switch to BOA 2.0. Somewhere along the way, the linkage to that got all messed up, and I think it may have been messed up on BOA 1.0, and I never noticed before. But strangely enough, I've gotten tons and tons of emails about this Paula Harris MP3 glitch over the last few weeks and months. So I'm definitely going to look into it once I find some time. Trust me, I'm well aware that there's a problem with that link at the BOA website. We're going to dig into it. We're going to find out, and I'll mention it here at the end of the show once it is fixed. But be patient. Could take another couple weeks or a month or so. I'm working like a dog this month here in December. Regarding the donation, first of all, thank you in advance for this donation you're going to make to BOA. I don't want to make anybody feel guilty, though. I felt guilty at the end of last week's episode because I delineated, you know, between the donors and the non-donors. I don't ever want to be like that. I don't want to ever have to force people to donate to BOA and turn this ship into a premium ride. That's not my intention at all. And I felt kind of guilty at the end of last week's season premiere because we had sort of drawn the line between donors and non-donors. But you're all together again now, folks. Don't worry. There's no bias or favoritism involved here. Believe me, I know times are tough for a whole lot of people, and I know that BOA provides some free entertainment to them that otherwise they may not be able to get if we had to charge them for it. I don't want anyone to ever feel guilty because they can't afford to donate to Banal America. Don't. Please. Don't feel guilty. It's my pleasure to provide you with the entertainment. And if you can help us out, if you have the extra change, then make the donation. But don't ever go hungry because you feel guilty and you donate to Banal America. That would just break my heart. So don't do that. Thank you for your insight on the favorite guests. Hope you enjoy digging into the BOA Audio Archive. I will definitely be in touch since you are in the Boston area. We're trying to put together a little coterie of BOA folks in the Massachusetts region. So anyone else in the Boston area or the suburbs of Boston, definitely shoot me a line because there's a good chance we'll get some stuff cooking here in 2011 for Boston BOA folks. That pretty much does it here on the emails. Once again, thank you to Pauline for writing in. Thank you to Brian. Thank you to Candace. And thank you to Sean. Congratulations, you're all part of the first BOA Audio listener feedback of Season 6. Before I give you the contact info, let's address one of the most famous hot topics here on BOA Audio listener feedback at the end of the show. Unfortunately, I don't have any new information about our beloved William Zabel. I tried contacting him, tried calling him, tried emailing him over the summer, did not hear from him yet again. William, if you're out there listening, dude, get in touch. People are talking and they're crying out for info on you and wondering where the hell you went. So get in touch with me, William, or if you know William Zabel, let me know what's going on, because I've just heard from countless people about this whole strange turn of events. If you want to be a part of future editions of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, if you have thoughts on this week's provocative edition of the program, let me know what you thought of Gian Casar's seriously mind-blowing Bigfoot research. Here are the means to get in touch with me. You can go to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. Click the contact button. That'll put you on the road to emailing me. Or you can just write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. And the other big method is to join up at the official BOA forum, the US of E.com, theusofe.com. It is BOA's paranormal playground, the official Banal of America forum, the US of E.com. Come on over, join up, join in on the conversations, and have some fun with the gang at the US of E. And of course, I'm part of all those different social networks, although I'm on the verge of ditching MySpace once and for all. But I'm still there for now, barely ever logging in. So you can reach me primarily at Facebook, also Twitter, and then finally MySpace. Befriend me, follow me, poke me, it's all good. One last note on listener feedback. I've gotten a ton of super long emails. Sit tight, folks who wrote those emails. I will get back to you in due time. Trust me, it takes a while to dissect those emails and respond to them and put the time and effort in to the response that you put into this long email that you send me. Trust me, I read them all, and I try to get back to you guys as soon as possible. I think that wraps up listener feedback. Get in touch with me if you want to be a part of future segments of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, or just want to share your thoughts on the program and the website as a whole. Looking forward to hearing from all you great folks out there. Up next, it is the thanks portion of the show. Allow me to roll through the list of the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, our contributing cartoonist Andy Carolan, and our webmaster Jeremy Boston. The updates have been a little light at BOA over last week, and that is entirely my fault. I'm actually sitting on three new columns from the outstanding BOA staff, Richard Thomas, Leslie, and Regan Lee. Those will be posted also in short order. Trust me, over the course of the next week, you're going to be able to read a lot of cool stuff from the BOA staff. I've just been insanely busy, but we've got them all locked and loaded and ready to roll. We say it week in and week out here at the end of the program, but it bears repeating because it is true. If you're only listening to Banal of America audio and you're not reading the columns at BOA, then you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Traditionally, this is the part of the program where we ask you to make a donation to BOA and help support Banal of America. I already sort of talked about this. I don't want to beat a dead horse. So let me just give you the means to make the donations if you can. First, you can go to Banal of America. There's a donate PayPal button right there on the homepage. Click that. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It is safe and secure. But maybe you don't trust PayPal. Maybe you don't trust the internet and you want to make a snail mail donation. Well, you can do that as well. Here's the address to mail donations to. It is as follows. Tim Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. Once again, Tim Binall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T, Mass. 01866. Couple of notes on the snail mail donations. First of all, include an email address with your donation so I can shoot you a line and say thanks. And in addition to that, if you're going to send me a check, please make it out to Tim Binall and not Binall of America. My bank, they're just sticklers about this sort of thing, and they get on my case big time if the check is made out to Binall of America and not Tim Binall. So from their lips to your ears, make the checks payable to Tim Binall and thank you, thank you, thank you to all the folks out there who have been making donations and who will be making donations in the future. You are doing a huge part in keeping BOA and Banal of America up and running, commercial free and freely available for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. Next week on the program, our guest is Bix Weir. He is the man behind the Road to Ruta Financial Conspiracy Theory. And much like this week's edition of the program here with Gian Kassar, next week's edition of the program will be Bix Weir's first ever interview on his Road to Ruta conspiracy theory. Bix is going to detail his unique theory that the current financial crisis was actually created by beneficent forces within the banking industry in order to return the United States to prosperity, thwart a new world order, and return America to a gold standard. We'll find out how he came to these conclusions and what they mean for the U.S.'s financial crisis going forward. It's an educational, albeit terrifying, edition of the program that will have you watching the mainstream news with a more jaundiced eye. It's Bix Weir talking about the Road to Ruta conspiracy theory on BOA Audio Season 6 next week. Check it out. And on that note, I've talked far too much here at the end of the show, but I want to get a lot out there, especially with the return of listener feedback. So once again, let me thank Gian Kassar for coming on the show. Check out the book, Recasting Bigfoot. It will blow your mind, folks. And thanks to Pauline, Brian, Candace, and Sean for contributing to BOA Audio listener feedback. You guys rock. And by extension, the BOA Audio listeners rock as well. Thank you for jumping back on the ship. You are the fuel that drives the machine. You are the BOA Audio listeners. You are the best. And I can't thank you enough for your support. Thank you once again for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. So until next time, this is Tim Binall, thanking you for listening and signing off.